Okay, well, good morning, everyone. And good morning, Mr. Page. On the count of three. One, two, three.
Good morning, Mr. Page.
Well, we hope you feel welcome, Mr. Page. Let everybody that is here in the room. All right. I just want to recap just a little bit to get the main lesson out of the case of Ahab. You will remember the major confrontation that Elijah confronted Ahab, the prophets of Baal, on Baal's own sacred territory, Mount Carmel, and the subsequent events that took place after that. The main point I think we ought to get out of it is the fact that Ahab did not exercise faith. He did not exercise faith. Even when he knew who God was, even when he did know who God was, and God had demonstrated it very, very clearly to him on Mount Carmel and by the words of Elijah, he still did not do what he was supposed to do. And so therefore, since he knew who God was, that God showed him, that God said he would help him out, he still did not believe. And I think that's a very important lesson for us to learn today. That brings us up as we continue the saga. And by the way, you might want to get out this this sheet. It's the chronological chart of significant events in biblical history, from Abraham to the captivity of Judah. All right, you might want to get out that and look at that. We'll be looking at it in a few moments. You didn't get that one? Oh, well, I'll look at it and tell you about it then, okay? Well, if you haven't got it, that's fine. I'll just refer to it. And when you do get it, then this should have been handed out, I would have thought, at this juncture, at this point of time. Nevertheless, anyway. 1 Kings chapter 20. We carry on a fascinating story here. We can only skip over the highlights, and I would suggest you do so. May I recommend, if you can get a hold of it, A Harmony of Samuel, Kings, and Chronicles by Crockett. Okay? This is very handy. I had this as a student going through World Mystery, as it was called back then, in the early 60s. Still is a mystery. Still working on it. I think we always will be. But may I recommend that to you. It does help, and it does put the events in a fairly good chronological order. All right. 1 Kings chapter 20, we mentioned Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria, gathered his host together, and there were 32 kings with him, etc. All right, these were vassal kings. Ben-Hadad had conquered. He had his empire. They were in subjection to him. And verse 2, he sent messengers to Ahab, king of Israel, into the city and said, thus said Ben-Hadad, I'm going to take your silver and gold. And this is a little repetitious. We will hurry on through. This is a hostile, unfriendly takeover. This is the first joust. And of course, Ahab replies, okay, what do you want? I'm quite prepared to negotiate and bargain on this. And of course, the message comes back from Ben-Hadad, you can say what you want, more or less, but anyway, I'm going to send in my servants tomorrow, verse 6, and anything that is pleasant in your sight, I am going to take. This was an extremely hostile takeover. All right? No room for maneuvering. And so the king of Israel called the elders and said, look what he's doing, and we might as well stand up and fight. If he's going to come in and wipe us out, we might as well just have a head on. And so that's what it came down to be. Verse 13. Behold, there came a prophet unto Ahab, king of Israel, saying, thus says the Lord, have you seen all this great multitude? Behold, I will deliver it into your hand this day. And of course, Ben-Hadad, with his 32 vassal kings, had an enormous amount of manpower to call on. And the point was, God said, look, you're looking at all of this host gathered around you, looking at it from a purely strategic point of view, you're going to lose, in essence, but I will deliver them, and the point being, and you shall know that I am the Eternal. All right? You shall know, Ahab, again, if you like. You've already had Mount Carmel. Now you've got another miracle here. And we read that the story goes on to say that surely God delivered Ahab from that particular battle. Now, as we see in verse 20, they slew everyone, his man. The Syrians fled, Israel pursued them, and Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, escaped on a horse with the horsemen. And the king of Israel went out and smote them in chariots, and there was a great slaughter. And verse 22, the prophet came to the king of Israel and said to him, go, strengthen yourself, mark, and see what you do, for the return of the king of Syria will come up, the return of the year the king of Syria will come up against you. And you will remember that it was in the dry season that kings went out to make war. And the servants of the king of Syria, after they went home, licked their wounds, gathered their forces together, and said, what did we do wrong? And all the Monday morning quarterbacking took place. And said, right, we'll go back down next year. We found out the answer. The king of Syria said to him, the servants of the king of Syria, their gods are the gods of the hills. Therefore, they were stronger than we. But let us fight them in the plain, and surely we shall be stronger than they are. All right, so we see the religious impact coming in here as to why they lost the battle. And so they said at the end of verse 25, we'll fight against them in the plain, and surely we're stronger than they are. And so he listened to the voice, down they came. And at the end of verse 27, the Syrians filled the country, and there came a man of God again to Ahab and spoke to the king of Israel and said, thus says the Lord, because the Syrians have said, the Lord is the God of the hills, and he is not a god of the valleys, therefore will I deliver all this great multitude into your hand. Again, a second time. So Ahab has had plenty of proof, demonstration, if you like, miraculous intervention on behalf of God to demonstrate who was the Eternal. And at the end of the verse it says, and you shall know that I have the Eternal. So there's no question on both of these miracles of intervention militarily, and again what happened on Mount Carmel, Ahab had no excuse. And we see that the prophet said, and the whole point of it is, you shall know who the true God really is. But Ahab had to do something. Ahab had to do something in this. Why did God's prophet give him this message? What was the point? It was not in the beginning of the text as to what Ahab had to do, but it is in the end of the text. It is afterwards that there's an instruction that Ahab had to do something. And in the light of these miracles, you'd have thought that Ahab would have got the point that he should obey God. But he did not. He had to do something after the victory. And that was, he was commanded by God to put to death Ben-Hadad and all his top military leaders. But what did Ahab do? Well, let's have a look, verse 30. But the rest of Aphek into the city, and there the wall fell upon 27,000 men, and the men that were left, 7,000 of the men that were left, and Ben-Hadad fled and came to the city into an inner chamber, hiding out. His servant said in verse 31, behold, now we have heard the kings of the house of Israel are merciful kings. Let us pray, put on sackcloth on our loins, ropes on our heads, and go to the king of Israel. Both of these, the sackcloth and, quote, ashes, royalty or those in high positions of authority wearing this was a sign of abject humility. The ropes on their heads signal captivity. In other words, they were in subjection, like as it were a leash or something like that. And so, verse 32, they did so, and came to the king of Israel, and said, your servant Ben-Hadad said, I pray you, let me live. And he, Ahab, said, is he yet alive? He is my brother. He is my brother. And what did this mean? Why on earth, after Ben-Hadad came down and attacked him twice, would he turn around and say, he is my brother? Let's read on. Now the men diligently listened, watching very carefully. After all, when your life is on the line, literally, you become extremely attentive, do you not? So the men listened and observed diligently whether anything would come from it, and they said, your brother, caught on immediately, oh yes, your brother, Ben-Hadad, your brother, Ben-Hadad, Then he said, go, bring him. And then Ben-Hadad came forth to him, and he caused him to come up into his chariot. Here is a symbolic action, and there were many such symbolic actions which were meant to have great significance for all around to see and to understand, and it said a lot. It said volumes that to have a king defeated and brought up into your chariot was a sign of treating him as an equal. A sign of treating him as an equal and not as a defeated person. And obviously one could imagine that Ben-Hadad would be extremely grateful, probably couldn't even believe his luck, in quotes, that he was being treated this way. It was far beyond whatever he could have expected. And verse 34, as a result of this, certain payments would have to be made. Ben-Hadad said unto him, verse 34, the sinners which my father took from your father, this was not literally his father, but rather his grandfather. Here we have this term from my father equals really a predecessor, someone who lived before him. In this case, it was his grandfather. So when he had come down, Ben-Hadad the first came down and captured these territories, now he was offering to restore them back, and these were very important prized areas. The cities which my father took from your father, I will restore. And you shall make streets for you in Damascus as my father made in Samaria. The important part about this for us to understand, the reference to streets, you'll remember that Ben-Hadad's father attacked Israel, not his grandfather, I'm sorry I got that wrong, Ben-Hadad's father attacked Israel and had taken these, he fought against Bashan, which you covered, and he'd taken these cities and had put in the streets, to emphasize the word streets, he had made in fact what were souks or merchant quarters, things like this, and the whole point behind this was a question of rivalry, of commerce, of trade, etc. This is the whole point. This is what he's making here. He said, I will make streets for you in Damascus. This summer when we were in Damascus, I don't know if Donna or Hope saw this, but you go down the old souk. Yes? It went down the old souk, and as you went to the end of the souk, of course this was after these particular events, right there are Roman columns and pillars that have been standing now 1,000 years or so, that's all, that had been established in Damascus as part of the souk, the colonnade there. Now obviously the lot of the material has changed, but here you see the evidence. This area has been a souk and been used for thousands of years. There are areas that are set aside. There's the gold souk and there's the copper souk, particularly over in Aleppo, which is due north approximately of Damascus, where certain areas are set aside for commerce and trade. And this is the point that is being made here. The streets for you in Damascus, as my father made in Samaria. And so he came down, established the souks, if you like, the areas of commerce and trade in Samaria. Then said Ahab, I will send you away with this agreement, this covenant, this deal. And so he made him a covenant with him and sent him away. Underlying the point that the whole point of this exercise was commercial rivalry to control the northern trading routes. So he made an alliance. As a result of this alliance, the prophet came, verse 35, a certain man of the sons of the prophet said to his neighbor in the word of the Lord, smite me. And so he would not do it. And he said, you've disobeyed the voice of my me, and a lion is going to slay you. And surely he did. So he said it again to another man, and smote him. And he said, thanks very much. Sat down beside the road, waited for Ahab to come by. Ahab came by, and then the prophet said that he'd been wounded and so forth. And he took, verse 41, ashes on his face, and the king of Israel discerned that he was of the prophets. Verse 41. Now we come down to the whole point behind this as to what God expected Ahab to do in the light of his victory over Ben-Hadad. Verse 42. He said unto him, because, thus says the Lord, because you have let go out of your hand a man, specifically Ben-Hadad, whom I appointed to utter destruction. Okay? This is what we did not see earlier on in the text, and we have to come towards the end of the text to understand what the prophet had told Ahab to do. He said, you go in there and you wipe them out. And he didn't do it. Because you have let go out of your hand a man whom I appointed to utter destruction, therefore your life shall go for his life, and your people for his people. And so whereas it should have been that had Ahab obeyed and actually wiped out this king Ben-Hadad and his people, God said to him, all right, I've given you two miracles in battle. I gave you a miracle to show you who I was on Mount Carmel. You've disobeyed me again. You have not walked in faith, despite the fact that I've demonstrated miraculously to you that I am God. Therefore, this is going to be the punishment that you should have carried out of my word on this man. I'm going to bring on your nation and on you, and you're going to die. Verse 43. The king of Israel went to his house heavy and displeased and came to Samaria. And we do not know why Ahab refused to kill Ben-Hadad. We do not know the answer to that. But we do know the circumstances behind the story in secular history. The Bible does not give us the answer here in Scripture. We go through chapter 21, which we'll buzz over very quickly. Naboth's vineyard, we've already discussed that. And we'll come to chapter 22. A very important statement is made here in verse 1. And they continued 3 years, and Hadad and Ahab, without war between Syria and Israel. We have this period of quiescence, time of peace. And it came to pass, the third year, Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, came down to the king of Israel. All right. Between the time, we find, between the time of the battle and the time of the alliance and the agreement for certain cities to be given back to Ahab by Ben-Hadad, that the battle of the period of 3 years went by, and then a battle came up as a result of Ramoth-Gilead. If you look at the strategic place, Ramoth-Gilead was a very, very important place, and the battle came as a result of the city not being returned to Ahab as Ben-Hadad had agreed. Okay? There was an enormous confrontation as well, and conflagration as well, taking place on the scene between the Syrian Empire that was trying to expand westward. And the Syrian Empire was being prevented from doing so by a group of 12 northwestern Semitic kingdoms fighting a common enemy. The Bible does not cover this particular point. Okay? There was a huge war taking place, that had taken place between the Syrian Empire, which was trying to expand westward, and it was prevented from doing so by a huge group of 12 northwestern Semitic kingdoms, all fighting a common enemy. Secular sources record the names of these ringleaders and of the coalition: Ben-Hadad and Ahab. This is why we can see the favorable treatment given and the disobedience towards God, because Ben-Hadad could no doubt see, really, when he looked at it, that the battle that was on their hands between Ben-Hadad and Ahab was small, relatively speaking. But now you see this monster in the east and the north, Assyria, gathering up its might and coming on across west and down south to overtake that territory. And we're not talking about kindergarten now. We're talking about big league. We're talking about a huge problem. So they all gathered themselves together. And the battle was the Battle of Carchemish, 854 B.C. 854 B.C., a very, very important battle at that time. And again, Ahab did not have enough faith. And this must be a very, very important lesson for us to learn out of this story. Ahab did not have enough faith to believe that God could save him from this Big enemy. Big time league. Assyrian Empire. Okay? He did not have enough faith that God would save him. The lesson obviously is a warning for us. It must be that we must surely learn something out of history if we learn it as we go through this class. I'm going through a little bit of a personal trial right now. And I said to my wife on the Sabbath morning, I said, look, you know, if we can't trust God and walk in faith and say, God, you know what's going on, please be in my life, please do what is best for me, and be able to sit back and believe that God will do that, how can we flee to the place of safety? Because we're going to have to walk out of this house, we're going to have to walk out of this city, we're going to have to walk out of our job, we're going to have to leave everything basically behind, and if we can't do a simple thing right now, the personal trial we're going through, and trust God to work it out, how on earth can we do that? And isn't this the lesson that we should be learning also from Ahab and for ourselves? The warning is maintain contact with God. You need to have contact with God, and you need to practice walking in faith with God, as I'm getting an opportunity to do right now, because if we don't, when a big trial does come, then we will not be able to stand, and we will not walk with faith in God, with God then, because we haven't been practicing. And so we see Ahab failed that particular lesson, and we surely need to understand that in our own lives too. Alright, so that's the warning and the lesson for us. Ahab's period of time was a prosperous one. It was very prosperous. We have the alliance with the Arameans, okay, the Arameans, with Judah and Israel, the three-way alliance that was very convenient. And of course the key, the result of peace is prosperity. The result of peace is prosperity. When you have this three-way alliance between the Arameans and then Israel and Judah, then of course you see then that the key to peace and harmony and prosperity was this alliance. And this alliance also of course encompassed the seaport of Tyre. They weren't, as it were, wasting their time fighting each other. You know, there's nothing like internal strife, internal bickering, internal fighting to dissipate your energy, which could be placed elsewhere. And, you know, clearly in the work in the past, we've had times like that, where the work has still been done. It's not been done as frankly, as effectively as it should have been, but we've had internal problems. And, you know, when you're squabbling inside within the family, you can't devote your time to doing things that are beneficial and to the progress of the family. Alright? You can't do that. So, here we have a time of peace. Here we have a time of the three-way alliance, which was working very well. But towards the end of Ahab's reign, we have increased difficulties coming along. As a result of the curse that God pronounced on him, Ahab, because in 1 Kings chapter 20, verses 42 and 43, as a result of not killing Ben-Hadad. Number one, that he would lose his own life, and number two, that his people would be destroyed and suffer instead of the Aramean people. Remember that. This began to happen late in Ahab's life when Moab was subject to Israel, and Moab began to rebel. Moab began to rebel. Very, very beautiful on the Dead Sea, sort of north and west of the Dead Sea. That area there was Moab, and directly south of that, of course, was Edom. And so we see Moab under the control of Israel, and Edom under the control of Judah. All right. Why would that be important? Why would that be important to control those areas there?
Access to the
Port of Elat always has been important. Okay, control the trade route down there, and so of course Israel and Judah did. Alright, so the rebellion began in Ahab's day. At first it wasn't successful, but it did finally succeed in the reign of Jehoram, Ahab's son. Okay, the king of Moab rebelled. Note 2 Kings chapter 3 verse 1. Now Jehoram, son of Ahab, began to reign over Israel in Samaria. And again, to get the get an idea of the closeness, have you, any of you done the geography information that you know, the geography course, Mr. Pace teaches? Okay, how far is Samaria from Jerusalem? Anyone know? About?
Miles.
Not very far. You see, small terminology here. Only 20 miles, the two capitals are apart. So Jehoram, son of Ahab, began to reign over Israel and Samaria. The 18th year of Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, reigned 12 years. And reigned 12 years. All right, verse 4. Micha, king of Moab, all right, was a sheep master. And it's important to note that Jehoram wore evil in the sight of God, did not do like his father and mother, but he put away the image of Baal that his father had made. And nevertheless, he cleaved to the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, which made Israel sin. He departed not from them. What was the particular thing that Jeroboam did that made Israel sin? We mentioned it last time. All right, who has an answer? Yes, and what was that specifically? The two golden calves, one at Bethel and one at Dan. Okay, and didn't depart from that. Verse 4, Micha, king of Moab, was a sheep master and rendered unto the king of Israel 100,000 lambs. 100,000 rams with wool, and it came to pass when Ahab was dead that the king of Moab rebelled against the king of Israel. Alright, we have found in 1868 the Moabite stone, as it's called, or a stele, as it is termed today. And in Pritchard's Ancient and Near Eastern Text, page 320, the date of the stone is fixed by 2 Kings 3:4 here, as to 849 BC. I, Micha, son of Chemosh, king of Moab, the Dibonite, my father reigned over Moab 30 years. I reigned after my father, who made his high places for Chemosh in Quabah. Because he saved me from all the kings, caused me to triumph over all my adversaries. As for Omri, king of Israel, he humbled Moab many years. For Chemosh was angry at his land, and his son followed him, and he also said, I will humble Moab. In my time, he spoke thus, but I have triumphed over him, I and over his house, while Israel both perished forever. Now, Omri had occupied the land of Medeba, and Israel, who dwelt there in his time, and half the time of his son Ahab, 40 years, but Chemosh dwelt there in my time. So it's interesting just to key in there the god of Chemosh, and the fact that we can see very clearly the historical period of time that ties in with the Moabite stone, all right, or stele. And we see then that verse 9, the king of Israel went to the king of Judah and to the king of Edom. So we have these three groups coming together. And they fetched the compass and they gathered together to go down to Moab and to get the territory back. We see the result of this, which has already been mentioned, and I won't but take a moment to repeat verse 27. And he, the king of Moab, took his eldest son that should have reigned in his stead and offered him for a burnt offering, appealing unto his God, paying the ultimate sacrifice. And of course there was a great indignation against Israel. The Edomites didn't like this, no doubt the Israelites didn't like it either, or the Judahites, and they departed from him, returning to their own land. And so we see then that point is that rebellion was taking place, and you can read the rest of 2 Kings chapter 3. Jehoram encourages Jehoshaphat to go with him and to go down to the king of Edom to attack Moab. The king of Moab sacrificed his son, verse 27, to Chemosh, and they all left. The continuation of the story, very briefly, as the more problems and difficulties came on the dual kingdoms. The period of time, we don't have the time because I want to catch up, I got a little bit behind in the first lecture. Period of time of 2 Kings chapter 6 here, where you see terrible famine, absolutely terrible time when, verse 25, Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, came to besiege Samaria, the end of verse 24, and they besieged it until the ass's head sold for 4 score pieces of silver and a fourth part of a cab of dove's dung for 5 pieces of silver. Verses 28 and 29 shows that women cooked and ate their own children, a very, very terrible period of time, and we see not only Israel suffering from a terrible famine and siege, we see Judah suffering. Let's turn over to 2 Kings chapter 8 and verse 18. 2 Kings 8, verse 18. Well, let's pick it up in verse 16. The fifth year of Joram, son of Ahab, king of Israel, Jehoshaphat being then king of Judah, Jehoram, the son of Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, began to reign. 32 years old was he when he began to reign. He reigned 8 years in Jerusalem. He walked in the way of the kings of Israel, as did the house of Ahab. For the daughter of Ahab was his wife. You see, this tied together now with an alliance of marriage. And he did evil, that which was in the sight of God. And yet the Lord would not destroy Judah for David, his servant's sake, as he promised him, to give him a way, a light, and to his children, to give him always a light to his children. And in his days, Edom revolted under the hand of Judah and made a king over themselves. So Joram went out to Zer and all the chariots with him, and he rose by night and smote the Edomites which compassed him about him. And the captains of the chariots and the people fled to their tents, yet Edom revolted from under the hand of Judah unto this day. And Libnah revolted at the same time. So we see then both Moab and Edom now revolting against Israel and Judah respectively. The result of this would be what? As we mentioned briefly, the southernmost part of the king's highway was lost. And also the northern part of the king's highway was lost. Commerce was interrupted, and the income as a result of that commerce, those control points and choke points, was gone. The king of Damascus, Ben-Hadad, controlled the northern part, and prosperity began to go down. Now there was a renewal of conflict between Israel and the Arameans, which of course capital was Damascus at this time. Ben-Hadad, the one whom Ahab had spared, had a chief minister called Hazael, H-A-Z-A-E-L. And this is, I think, the only example that I know of in the Bible, and it's a period of time when the prophet Elijah was used to do something unique. He was asked to go and anoint this Aramean chief as a successor to his master, to Ben-Hadad. And we can see in 2 Kings chapter 8, verse 7, Elisha came to Damascus. Why? We don't know. We only know he was there. Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria, was sick, and it was told him, saying, "The man of God is come hither." And quite a simple communication. The king said, "Okay, take precedence, Hazael, and present in your hand, go meet the king, meet Elijah, and ask him, am I going to recover of this sickness?" So Hazael took him presents of every good thing of Damascus, 40 camels, burden. this wasn't just a gift. I mean, 40 camels worth of weight is an extremely generous, large outpouring. And of course, kings, when they're in this sort of position, can be extremely generous. And he was. We see then, carrying on in verse 9, stood before him and said, "Your son," a very honorific way of being polite, "your son Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, has sent me to you, saying, shall I recover of this disease that I've got?" And Elisha said unto him, "Go, say to him, you may certainly recover." In other words, this is not life threatening. "However, the Lord has shown me that he shall surely die." And if we can, get a little goosebumpy here. And he settled his countenance steadfastly, looked him in the eye, and stared at him. Okay, he fixed his eyes, and the two men stared at each other. You ever had a stare down like that? Eyeball to eyeball. To the point, until he, Hazael, was ashamed, or embarrassed, and he broke off the stare, probably. And the man of God wept. And Hazael said, "Why do you weep, my lord?" And he answered, "Because I know, Hazael, that you're planning to kill Ben-Hadad. And I know, Hazael, the evil that you will do to the children of Israel, my brethren. Their strongholds will you set on fire, and their young men will you slay with a sword, and will dash their children and rip open their women with child." And Hazael said, "What? Am I a dog?" I think you need to check out the meaning of that. I think it means, "Am I a prostitute? Am I a dog that I would do such a thing?" And Elisha said, "The Lord has shown me, yes you will, you're going to kill, you've been plotting against Ben-Hadad, I know it, and you know it, and you're going to kill him, and you will be king over Syria." So he departed from Elisha and came to his master, who said to him, "What shall Elisha say?" And he answered, "He told me that you should recover." "Good, fine." It came to pass on the morrow that he took a thick cloth, while Ben-Hadad was sick in bed and weak, he took a thick cloth, dipped it in water, spread it on his face, pressed his hand down on it, and smothered Ben-Hadad to death. So that he died, and Hazael reigned in his stead. So the penalty was beginning to come on Israel that God had promised as a result of Ahab's disobedience and lacking faith in trusting God. So Hazael murdered Ben-Hadad. It was not long after this that, of course, trouble did begin to come forth, and pressure was placed against Israel. Verse 25, "In the 12th year of Joram, son of Ahab, king of Joram, Ahaziah, the son of Joram, king of Judah, begin to reign." And verses 28 and 29 we see, "And he went with Joram, the son of Ahab, to the war against Hazael, king of Syria, in where? The same place that had caused problems before, Ramoth Gilead. And the Syrians wounded Jordan." So you see, you often wonder, why don't we just do what we say we're going to do and keep our word and there isn't a problem? Here we see that, of course, had the Ramoth Gilead been given back, then there wouldn't have been a problem. But it continued being a source of conflict. All right, so Joram was wounded. We have to rush through here. The prophet, chapter 9, calls to Elisha the prophet, rather, talks to Jehu, if we can understand what the situation is, that Jehu was now to be anointed king of Israel by Elisha. Jehu was to be anointed king of Israel, okay, by Elisha. And Jehu was the commander-in-chief of the armies of Joram. So we have Joram, who is the king, and we have Jehu, who is his CNC, commander-in-chief, and Jehu is anointed to supersede Joram. Let's review the circumstances. We remember we've had a revolt of Moab and Edom and renewed war between Israel and Aram, Ben-Hadad, the flashpoint being Ramoth-Gilead. Joram was wounded, and he was recovering in the palace at Jezreel. Remember, there are two, one in Jezreel and one in Samaria. And Jehu was at Ramoth-Gilead at the battle. Now, 2 Kings chapter 9, and verse 6 through 8, he, being Jehu, rose, went to the house, poured oil, he, being Elisha, went to the house and poured oil on his head, Jehu's, and said to him, "Thus said the Lord God of Israel, I have appointed you king over Israel. I have appointed you king over the people of the Lord, even over Israel. And you shall smite the house of Ahab, your master, that I may avenge the blood of my servants, the prophets, and the people, the blood of all of the servants of the Lord, at the hand of Jezebel." See, important lesson here we must learn. God will do the avenging in his time, and let God do that. Verse 8, the whole house of Ahab shall perish, and I will cut off Ahab, off from Ahab, him that, well, we don't need to look at that. You read ahead and you can see the terminology is not all that bright in today's terms. Alright, so we see then very clearly that Jehu now is anointed king. He leaves in verse 16 for Jezreel, and apparently he has a rather unusual style of riding. He is a very, very fast rider. So up on, if you know the topography, up on the hills, you can see down into the valley the cloud of dust coming. And so the guard sees this. We'll summarize it very quickly. Send out a messenger. The messenger didn't come back. Normally, when you send out a messenger, is it victory or is it a loss? The messenger comes back, we've won or we've lost. The messenger didn't come back. So they sent out a second one, verse 19, and the messenger didn't come back. And verse 21, Joram said, make ready, and his chariot was made ready, and Joram, king of Israel, and Ahaziah, king of Judah, together were here. And remember that Joram was recovering from his wounds. Even though he was wounded, he got into his chariot, and they went out to meet Jehu. And they met him in the portion of Naboth the Jezreelite. Interesting. Underline that. Naboth the Jezreelite. And it came to pass when Joram saw Jehu that he said, is it peace? And he answered, what peace? So long as the whoredoms of your mother Jezebel and her witchcrafts are many. So Joram turned his hands and fled. So Ahaziah said, there's treachery! Get out of here! Jehu got his bow and whoosh, between the shoulder blades, it came right out in between his heart, and he sunk down on his knee and sank, and the blood and the life ebbed out of him, and he died right there in his chariot. And verse 27, Ahaziah, the king of Judah, saw this, he fled away, and Jehu followed him, and he killed him as well. And in the 11th year of Joram, verse 29, the son of Ahab began Ahaziah to reign over Judah. And when Jehu was come to Jezreel, Jezebel heard it, and she painted her face, and she tried her head, tied her head, and looked out of the window, and Jehu said, throw her down! So he got rid of Jezebel, and we won't read the story of that. But very clearly, we can see then that a dramatic change of power has come, and we can see also that the message then is sent out. Ahab had 70 sons, and in Samaria, Jehu wrote letters to them, chapter 10, and said, one of you come up and fight me, man to man. They all said no. The end of verse 6 here, now the king's sons, being 70 persons, and this is a literary term, meaning he had many sons, and this was all of his sons, not necessarily 70 literally. Now the king's sons, being 70 persons, were with great men of the city which brought them up. And it came to pass when the letter came to them, that they took the king's sons, slew 70 persons, and put their heads in the baskets and sent them to Jezreel. So we see all of Ahab's house destroyed. And verse 18, sorry to rush so fast, but I think you really do need to read this to get the whole context. Jehu gathered all the people together and said unto them, Ahab served Baal little, Jehu shall serve him much. So we see an unusual situation. He gets all the people, verse 19, to gather together to sacrifice to Baal. But Jehu did it in subtlety. Okay? He did it subtlety, to the intent that he might destroy the worshippers of Baal. So he proclaimed a solemn feast. And all the top brass were there. And he issued all of the top brass and all of the people that were Baal worshippers come to this great congregation gathering or litter ephods unto Baal. Then he closed the doors and he said to his men, search. Is there anyone in here that is not a Baal worshipper? If that is so, get them out. And then he said at the end of verse 25, go in and wipe out every last person you can see. And an enormous bloodletting took place. The bloodletting of the top military, the top civil, and the top religious leaders of the entire nation. This was the bloodiest takeover in the northern kingdom of Israel. when all of the manpower was wiped out. Typically, in the past, only royal families, the immediate family was killed. Now, the king of Israel, the king of Judah, 42 of his family relations were wiped out. Jehu did wipe out Baalism, but he did not do everything he should have done. Verse 29. Howbeit, from the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who made Israel to sin, Jehu departed not from after them, to wit, or to note, the golden calves that were in Bethel and in Dan. For some reason, the two golden calves were permitted to remain. He drew the line at this. He did not do all wholeheartedly that which was right. And so we see verse 30. Because you've done well in executing that which is right in my eyes, and you've done unto the house of Ahab according to all that was in your heart, my heart, your children of the fourth generation shall sit on the throne of Israel. And so we see the longest established dynasty of four generations takes place. And now we see in verse 32, in those days the Lord began to cut Israel short, and Hazael smote them in all the coasts of Israel, and it mentions all of the places, until finally Jehu sinks. So we see the wheel turning, Hazael taking over certain territory. He took away the king's highway. Eventually he captured the entirety of it down to Elath and also the Via Maris. Israel reaches its lowest point before its final captivity by the Assyrians at Hazael's expansion. Okay? This is the lowest point before its final captivity. This all came about from the time of Ahab, when Ahab refused to destroy Ben-Hadad, as we read in 1 Kings chapter 20. It was left open and weak. The nation was left open and weak of Israel. Israel as a nation was left open as a weak, open and weak, as a result of Jehu's purging. The buzzer's going to go, but hang on, because I really do want to finish this. And that of itself need not have been a fatal thing. What was fatal was the fact that Jehu, having taken the nation, should have taken it back totally to God. If Jehu had done this and obeyed God, not only putting out Baalism but destroying the golden calves as well and trusting in God, God would have protected them. But in that sense, Jehu was half-hearted. He did not remove the golden calves. Consequently, the purges of Jehu destroyed the three-way alliance between Israel, Judah, and Tyre. And both then, as a result of Judah and Tyre losing their royal families, they're not going to have an alliance. And so Hazael, the new rising star, came in, and the Tyranians allied themselves with Hazael. They broke off their alliance with Israel, allied themselves with Hazael, and the prosperity of the kingdoms was gone as a result of the disobedience. Now I will just mention here, I think what it would be best to do at this point is to stop now. I wish I could finish, but obviously I've been too loquacious, and Mr. Page, carry on there.